Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that Donald Trump has compromised a vital intelligence operation against the Islamic State and speak with a former FBI supervisory special agent who investigated and supervised highly sensitive international terrorism cases such as the East Africa embassy bombings by al-Qaeda and their attack on the USS Cole. Ali Soufan joins us to discuss how painstakingly difficult it is to penetrate terrorist groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS compared to how easy it is to blow an operation, as apparently Trump has done. And his latest book, Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State, which is a compelling and definitive account of how and why bin Laden's ideology keeps rising from the dead, with his son Hamza now poised to take over the growing organization that his father founded. Then we will look into today's White House meeting between President Trump and President Erdogan of Turkey that was bound to end in disappointment for Erdogan, who is demanding the extradition of the cleric he blames for the coup against him, Gulen, and that the U.S. cut its ties with the Syrian Kurds, who are the only fighting force the Pentagon can count on to defeat ISIS and take their Syrian capital, Raqqa. Max Hoffman, a policy analyst on national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, joins us to discuss Trump's business ties in Turkey and why the U.S. president was almost alone in congratulating Erdogan's power grab in narrowly winning the recent disputed referendum. Then finally, we will speak with Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. He joins us to discuss a comparison that the United States ambassador to the UN has made between the Assad regime and the Nazis, following the revelation that a crematorium has been installed in a Syrian prison to dispose of the bodies of the thousands of Syrians the regime systematically murders. And joining us now is Ali Soufan, who's the chairman and CEO of the Soufan Group, a New York-based strategic security intelligence consulting firm, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation supervisory special agent. He investigated and supervised highly sensitive and complex international terrorism cases, including the East Africa embassy bombings, the attacks on the USS Cole, and the events surrounding 9/11. His latest book, just out, is Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Soufan.
Thank you.
And obviously, I want to talk to you about how 6 years after bin Laden was killed, al-Qaeda is making a comeback, and certainly its spawn is Daesh, the Islamic State, is capturing the attention of the world as it has for some time. But just to touch on the moment, which is sort of inescapable, you having been an intelligence officer, you, I'm sure, understand the kind of pyramid where at the basis of the pyramid, all of the gathering goes on with all the spies around the world, and then it's filtered up through analysis and finally reaches the pinnacle of the pyramid. And the number one consumer sitting right at the pinnacle of the pyramid is the President of the United States. And now we have a situation where information apparently that relates to the Islamic State has perhaps been shared with the Russians inadvertently, perhaps. How does that make you feel as a former intelligence officer, and if this is indeed the case?
Well, if it's the case, this is very concerning. The president legally have the authority to declassify any intelligence he thinks appropriate. However, the concerning part here that we did not own that intelligence. The United States government did not own the intelligence that was shared with a hostile power that we have to assume if we're working very closely with the country that provided us that intelligence, that the Russians are also considered hostile service for that specific country. Sharing the intelligence with the Russians can generate a lot of concerns for the people who provided us the intelligence in the first place, and probably it might compromise sources and methods, which is really, really concerning. So I don't know the detail of what happened, what kind of intelligence, under what program, who provided it, what is the impact on sources and methods. But just if you want to take the article in the Washington Post and the confirmations in New York Times and Reuters, you know, at face value, this should raise significant concerns. Is it legal? Absolutely. Is it careless? You bet.
And would it be possible then for the Russians, assuming that this we know that they got the information, and apparently it mentioned the actual place in Syria, the ISIS-held place where I guess they make these laptop bombs, which are extremely serious. Obviously, that's the next line of attack, apparently, that Daesh is planning on. Could the Russians reverse engineer it? Because assuming it's, say, the Jordanians have probably got the best network in that part of the world, couldn't the whole network get rolled up? Isn't that possible?
Well, this is what's scary about it. And, you know, I think I don't want to comment on intelligence that I don't know what the intelligence, you know, is in the first place. However, sometimes sharing the intelligence and exposing the intelligence without exposing sources and methods can compromise the sources and methods. So I'll give you an example. If I told you about something that you did yesterday and you thought about it and you're like, you know what, I never said that to anyone except on the phone, then you can assume that I am monitoring your phone, right? So I exposed my sources and methods by telling you a piece of intelligence. So you can definitely figure out the sources and the methods. It depends on the intelligence itself. It depends on what's being shared. I don't know what exactly the topic that was shared, the details of it, under what programs it fits. What is the assets on the ground? Was it technical assets, human assets? The only thing we know is what the Washington Post published, that this is a very sensitive program that was not shared even with other U.S. intelligence agencies and our closest allies, meaning the Five Eyes. It was specifically to the United States intelligence service that got the intelligence from the foreign power to share it with the political leadership in Washington. If this is the situation, and from the intelligence you can determine sources and methods, then that's a very, very careless thing to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Soufan. He's the chairman and CEO of the Soufan Group, a New York-based strategic security intelligence consulting firm, a former Federal Bureau of Investigations supervisory special agent. He investigated and supervised highly sensitive and complex international terrorism cases, including the East Africa embassy bombings, the attack on the USS Cole, and the events surrounding 9/11. And his latest book, just out, is Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. So turning to Bin Laden, and this sort of reincarnation of al-Qaeda with Bin Laden's own beloved son Hamza more and more looking like the new sort of spearhead. Again, from your experience, since you were on the Bin Laden case from the very beginning, and it was clear that Bin Laden was a serial killer after the Africa embassy bombings and then the Cole, I guess the lesson here, which relates to what we've just been talking about with the breaking story at the moment, is that it's incredibly difficult to get inside this organization, is it not? And that's the real challenge. So obviously, when you finally get somebody on the inside, the last thing you want to do is blow their cover.
Absolutely. Absolutely. These are very sensitive operations, and a lot of thinking and assets go into conducting them.
And in terms of this comeback after, well, let's put it in context. In early 2011, when the Middle East was roiling under the Arab Spring, Bin Laden in the Abbottabad in Pakistan, right near the military headquarters, or the equivalent of West Point for the Pakistani army.
Yeah, down the road.
he's watching all of this unfold, and then he declares that the next stage will be the reinstating of the rule of the caliphate. And then 6 years later, al-Qaeda's spin-off, Daesh, the Islamic State, has proclaimed itself the caliphate. And, of course, to some extent, it's being rolled up. So let's start with that. What is the relationship between al-Qaeda and the Islamic State or Daesh?
Well, the Islamic State was Al-Qaeda branch in Iraq. During the Iraq War, everybody probably from your audience remember a guy by the name of Mus'ab al-Zarqawi. He is the one who set up Al-Qaeda branch in Iraq. Later on, that branch named themselves the Islamic State in Iraq. They continued to pledge bayat to bin Laden, and they pledged allegiance after bin Laden to Ayman Zawahiri. And after the Syria war, there was a division between Al-Qaeda and some members of the affiliate in Iraq. The Iraqis wanted to have the Syria jihad under them. Ayman Zawahiri wanted the Syria jihad to be separate from the Iraqi jihad. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq split into two organizations, Al-Qaeda in Syria called al-Nusra and Al-Qaeda in Iraq named themselves the Islamic State. They disagreed with Zawahiri's decision, so they called themselves the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, insisting that Syria and Iraq are one. And they do not recognize the Sykes-Picot, which is the French-British deal that separated the countries in the Middle East after the Ottoman Empire. And they separated themselves from Al-Qaeda. A lot of people in ISIS, they consider themselves bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. They don't like to be Zawahiri's Al-Qaeda. So ISIS, ideologically speaking, is a branch of that poisonous tree that was planted by Osama bin Laden. They are followers of the Osama bin Laden's narrative. Now, they established a caliphate in order to basically tell Al-Qaeda leadership in Waziristan, or what was called at the time and continue to be called, actually, Khorasan, that, you know what, you're on the run. We established a state, and now you have to give us bay'ah. You have to give us oath of allegiance. Al-Qaeda believed that it's not time to establish a caliphate yet. It is time to take advantage of the chaos that is taking place in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, in the Sahel, and build the network, rebuild the organization, embed yourself with the chaos of the civil wars and geopolitical conflicts that's happening around the Middle East, find more recruits. And then, and only then, when you prevent anyone from filling that chaos, then you can start thinking about establishing a state and preparing for the final confrontation with the West. Their strategy is called management of savagery. Al-Qaeda still believe they are in phase two. ISIS jumped to phase three. And I think soon as we see, ISIS continues to dwindle, but its parent organization, Al-Qaeda, appears to be making a comeback, because Al-Qaeda now have affiliates that are, doing significant participation in civil wars in places like Iraq and in places like Syria and places like Yemen. Just in Syria, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is considered the affiliate of Al-Qaeda, have probably about 20,000 people. In Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the most dangerous affiliate, they were involved in mostly all the terrorist attacks in the West, after 9/11, especially with Al-Awlaki, the underwear bomber, Charlie Hebdo, the printer bombing plot that was disrupted, Anwar al-Awlaki and his sermons that generated a lot of passion among Qaeda followers and the global jihadi followers in Western countries, and especially the English-speaking countries. They used to have less than 1,000 before the Yemen war. And today, Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula have more than 4,000 to 5,000 members. So they are growing in numbers. Remember, bin Laden had only 400 members, pledged members, on the eve of 9/11. And that's what I try to show in the book. I try to have a better understanding of the threat, a better understanding of the narrative and the ideology. And by delving into the personalities of people who want to make us, want to do us harm, people who created, and men who created so much bloodshed and grief around the world, understanding how they view the world, what are their motivations, how do they operate, how do they see the political and the geopolitical changes, and see the world through them. And hopefully that 15 years or 16 years after 9/11, we can finally start to have the deeper understanding of the enemy, the understanding that Sun Tzu, told us about centuries ago, that if you know your enemy and know yourself, you will win 100 times in 100 battles. Unfortunately, until now, we don't have that understanding of that hydra of terrorism that's called Al-Qaeda and its narrative.
But it seems to me that you have a kind of both a virtual caliphate and an actual physical caliphate, and that's what makes it so lethal. In other words, it's often been said that you cannot bomb Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State out of existence, so even though clearly they are suffering reverses on the battlefield.
But sure,
very difficult, as you know. It's a hard slog in Mosul and in Raqqa, and there's going to be an awful lot of casualties. But in the sense that it is a virtual caliphate, it's embedded in theology. That's the other argument, surely, that are they more vulnerable, or is it more useful to go after the theology than the converts who've picked up the gun? In other words, is there a way that you can ban takfir?
Well, this is actually a very interesting question, and I think Al-Qaeda is not at the caliphate stage yet, and they never announced that they established the caliphate. ISIS have a physical caliphate, and that physical caliphate, with all the allegiances that they have from so many different people, is based on a physical state. Even their slogan, Baqiya wa Tatamaddad, remaining and expanding. Without that physical state, there is no caliphate. Without that physical state, ISIS goes back from a proto-state to an underground terrorist organization, as they started. Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, took the orders from Osama bin Laden at the time the Arab Spring was unfolding. He told them, everything I told you before about only targeting the West and the United States, put it on hold. This is a historic moment that we did not see in the Muslim world since the time of Saladin. What you need to do is, we need to take advantage of this chaos that's unfolding, and we need to basically be sure that there's no body who's going to fill that vacuum, because whoever is going to fill that vacuum is going to be the next dictator and the next traitor to the West and to the Americans. So that means a lot of Muslims need to die. That means we have to kill a lot of people, but we have to kill them to save them. We have to kill them to save them. And he repeated it twice in one of his letters to his commanders. And that specific order that Osama bin Laden gave just before he was killed, basically undermined not only the Arab Spring, but undermined the entire order of power in the region. And I think this is where we are today. We are in a situation where ISIS is dwindling, and this caliphate is being defeated in the street of Mosul, and it will be defeated in Raqqa. But also at the same time, Al-Qaeda is expanding. And Al-Qaeda have now a foothold in so many different countries in the Muslim world. For example, as I told you before, we know about their presence in Syria and in Yemen. Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, reunited all these different factions regarding to ethnic and tribal affiliations. So now you have the Berber and you have the Fulanis and you have the Arabs operating all under the banner of the AQAIM, under the leadership of Abu Mus'ab Abdelwadud, who's an Algerian. A lot of these ethnic groups have their own Qaeda affiliates because they didn't want to operate under an Arab. The situation now is different. So it seems that at least in a Sahel region in North Africa, they overcame the tribal and the ethnic division that hindered their operations before. So Al-Qaeda is very dangerous today, and many of the leaders, the top leaders who have been with Osama Osama bin Laden from day one, not only Ayman Zawahiri, people like Saif al-Adl al-Masri, people like Abu Muhammad al-Masri, are still alive. And now we see al-Qaeda trying to present Hamza bin Laden, the son of Osama bin Laden, who is known to many Qaeda members from the early days. As a kid, he was featured in many of the propaganda videos of al-Qaeda. It seems that they are preparing him to take leadership of the organization. I think Hamza, having the bin Laden name, being known to many of the global jihadis around the world, can have the power if he played his cards right, and if the traditional leaders of al-Qaeda played their cards right, to unify the global jihadi movement and bring back many of those people who went and joined ISIS after there is no caliphate. So there are so many different political issues here, so many different security concerns here in this. And yes, theology is part of it. The narrative is part of it. Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all these global jihadis, they claim that they are defenders of Islam. And they claim that their whole war is based on the West and the United States being at war with the Muslim world, and they are defending Islam. And we have to expose the hypocrisy of groups like this, expose the hypocrisy of groups that bomb markets in the Muslim world, bomb mosques, even bomb the mosque of the Prophet himself in Medina in Saudi Arabia, killing more Muslims than they are killing anyone else. Almost 90% of their victims are Muslims, and claim that they are the defenders of Islam. We have to expose that, and that will be kind of one of the main things we need to do in order to cut the neck of that hydra, expose the hypocrisy of this movement that they claim they are defending Islam and they are defending Muslims.
But Ali Sufan, when you say we have to, obviously Christians and Jews have no credibility in this issue, that the people who have the credibility to deal with this theological perversion of takfir, the religious sanction to kill, as you mentioned, bin Laden says you have to kill to save. Is there a body, whether it's the Saudi Wahhabis or in Egypt, is there a body with the sufficient credibility that can argue with the full weight of authentic Islam against this perversion? Because it always comes up every time there's a terrorist incident, the local imam comes out and says, you know, Islam is a religion of peace and we have nothing to do with violence. That's not ringing very true, and it's not very effective anymore, I'm afraid.
Well, just because it's not ringing true in the media, it does not reflect the reality on the ground. Most of the people who are fighting ISIS in Iraq or in Syria or in Yemen or in the Sahel are Muslims too. The people who are fighting them in the streets of Mosul today are Muslims too. Yes, Al-Azhar, for example, put their statements out, and other Islamic entities put their statements out, against these individuals. But, the situation is not only a situation of religious rhetoric. It's more than that. The situation is a geopolitical conflict where sectarianism is being used to create political and military advantage between countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, and Iran, and a sphere of influence that's held together by faith and backed by petrochemical dollars would be a strong force to reckon with. So there are so many different elements for this threat, And when I say we, I say we as counterterrorism, because yes, we need to coordinate with the Saudis. Yes, we need to convince our allies not to use sectarianism as a military and intelligence and geopolitical tools. But also at the same time, we have to be very careful with our terminology. We cannot say that we are against ISIS and they don't represent Islam and we want the Muslim world to help us, but say we want to do a Muslim ban, for example, or we don't want to allow Muslims to come in the country, or this is a clash of civilization. While it is an intra-civilizational clash, it's not a clash of civilization. It's not Muslims fighting Christians. It's Muslims fighting Muslims, Sunnis fighting Shia, Shia fighting Sunnis, Kurds fighting Turks, Turks fighting Persians, Persian fighting Arab. I mean, there's an inter-civilizational clash clash that's going on inside the Muslim world. So we have to be very careful in our terminology. We have to be very careful on in not doing something that's going to play into our enemy's handbook. And in my book, if you read how they view stuff like the invasion of Iraq, for example, or how they view torture, or how they viewed the images of Abu Ghraib, they were not sorry for the people who were killed or the people who were tortured, but they thought it's a great thing to take advantage of so they can have more recruits and more support among specific communities in Iraq and in the wider Muslim world. So, I think we need to continue to battle these groups. And I think we, all the good people in the world, Muslims, non-Muslims, Christians, Jews, atheists, this is a global war against terrorism. And, in the United States, we don't think of it as a religious war. We think of it as a war against the tactic of terrorism. And then we need to utilize all the tools in our toolbox, to include diplomacy, to include finding political solutions for conflict in Syria, for conflict in Yemen and other places, because trying to combat terrorism, trying to combat these groups without finding political solutions for these conflicts is trying to take, to put down a fire in a big tower using a small little towel. It's not going to work out. So the moment we start solving these civil wars, the appeal of these groups will diminish significantly. And then we have to wage war against them, not necessarily in the physical spaces that they occupy in Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Afghanistan or Somalia or in the Sahel. This is only half of the battle. We need to wage war against them in the space they occupy in the mind of the vulnerable and the alienated. And this is the hard part. And only when we begin waging that war, only when we begin fighting that battle, we might finally win this war. And I think we need to do that.
Well, Ali Safon, you've given us a lot to think about. I do hope that our leadership in Washington is abreast of the wisdom that you're providing us, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Safon, who's the chairman and CEO of the Safon Group, a New York-based strategic security intelligence consulting firm, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation supervisory special agent. He investigated and supervised highly sensitive and complex international terrorism cases, including the East Africa embassy bombings, the attack on the USS Cole, and the events surrounding 9/11. His latest book just out is Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the White House meeting today between President Trump and President Erdogan of Turkey. Back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, a policy analyst on the National Security International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks, Max. And what did you make of the meeting today at the White House between President Trump and President Erdogan, who's just won a referendum, very disputed, but of course Donald Trump was about the only, I think, certainly the first important Western leader to congratulate Erdogan essentially leaving half the Turkish population high and dry who didn't vote for him, who were not happy with this power grab. So let's start with that. I mean, what do you think is the motive for Trump being nice to this guy in that way that in effect undercuts all of the educated and urban Turks who are feeling the brunt of this purge that is underway as thousands are arrested and lose their jobs?
Well, you're certainly right that the visit comes in the context of, a severe degradation in U.S.-Turkish relations. The relationship's probably the worst it's been since the 1970s when we actually had an arms embargo on Turkey. And in the context of a very, very concerning authoritarian drift in Turkey. As you mentioned, Erdogan has consolidated control of the country. He just pushed through this very controversial referendum. And there were, several voting irregularities. And of course, the whole election was conducted in the midst of severe crackdown on opposition media and politicians. But Trump, he didn't, as you mentioned, he didn't seem to really mind any of that. He called to congratulate Erdogan. He was one of the first to do so. He actually did so after the State Department had issued a statement in conjunction with European government saying that they were waiting for the official certification of the results before commenting. And Trump picked up the phone to call Tayyip Erdogan and congratulate him. But it's really not surprising. It's in keeping with the Trump administration's policy thus far. It's extremely realistic and interest-based. Trump has had this sort of strange obsession with dictators, whether it's Fatah al-Sisi from Egypt or Rodrigo Duterte from the Philippines, and of course Erdogan and Putin. So it's in keeping with this approach. The meetings at the White House are ongoing, but the initial joint statement was both men were full of praise for the other. Both sort of used flattery as a tactic because they both believe the other to be vulnerable to that sort of thing. So Trump praised Turkish martial prowess. He praised Erdogan's strength, and Erdogan in return, congratulated Trump on what he called his legendary election triumph, which I'm sure is catnip to the president.
Certainly, that does sound like something that would win over Trump, since he seems to be so obsessed with keep repeating that his legendary Electoral College win. But of course, in 2015, Trump was interviewed by Breitbart News by none other than Stephen Bannon, who became his strategic advisor, when he talked about his conflict of interest with lots of business family holdings in Turkey, quoting Trump, "I have a little conflict of interest because I have a major building in Istanbul." So that's a pretty naked admission that maybe there is some reason why he's being nice to this fellow. But on the other hand, Erdogan is asking for the impossible, isn't he? He wants the U.S. to extradite Gulen, who's in exile. He has a green card, lives in the United States. And also he wants the U.S. to cut its ties with the YPG, the Syrian Kurdish militias, who are the only boots on the ground that the Pentagon have been able to find that could actually take on the Islamic State. And they're poised for a major offensive to capture Raqqa. And to do so, they require a lot of heavy equipment from the United States. And that, of course, is the main bone of contention, right?
That's absolutely right. The top priority for Erdogan on this visit was to try and get Trump and the U.S. government to reconsider the decision to conduct the final push on Raqqa with the Kurdish forces, or majority Kurdish forces, referred to as the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the YPG, variously. Turkey, of course, regards these guys as a terrorist organization, but the Pentagon strongly believes that they're the only group capable of retaking Raqqa on any acceptable time frame. Raqqa, of course, is a source of terrorist threats emanating out to Europe and, of course, most directly to Turkey. So it should really be in everyone's interest. Turkey, or the Turkish government, doesn't view it that way. Of course, they see the development of a Kurdish statelet on their southern border in northern Syria as a threat to their security. And they've been, they've been very resistant to cooperating with the U.S. in northern Syria on this set of issues. That's by far the top priority. There is next to no chance Erdogan will get his way there. The U.S. is moving forward with the Kurds, and that's that. So he'll be looking for concessions on that front. And the likely concessions are increased intelligence sharing on the PKK, the domestic Turkish-Kurdish separatist group, assurances about the future governance in northern Syria, that it will not be exclusively Kurdish or exclusively leftist Kurdish governed, that Arabs and Turkmen will have a say. And then also in northern Iraq, there is significant controversy surrounding the Sinjar area and Turkish concerns that both the Kurds and indirectly Iran will have too much influence in northern Iraq moving forward. So Trump may offer concessions on those things. On Gulen, the other major issue you mentioned, the Turks have been demanding his extradition since the coup attempt, which they believe Gulen orchestrated. They haven't presented any evidence to the U.S. government that has stood up to scrutiny. And I don't think Trump can afford to provoke another, constitutional crisis. Extradition process is governed by the judicial system, by the judges, in this case in eastern Pennsylvania, and the Justice Department. Trump can't short-circuit that even if he wanted to. So on the two major issues, as you said, there are really no wins for Erdogan here. You also mentioned the conflict of interest, which, it's a very important issue. You mentioned the towers in Istanbul, and Trump and his family received up to $5 million a year, received currently up to $5 million a year in income from those properties, according to his very incomplete financial disclosure. The other big conflict here is Michael Flynn, the departed, fired national security advisor. He was a paid agent indirectly of the Turkish government through a businessman very close to the Turkish government. And at the time, he was making extremely important strategic decisions on behalf of the United States regarding Turkey. It was a direct conflict of interest. In fact, the reason we are still, the U.S. and Turkey are still arguing over the YPG announcement is because Flynn, during the transition, rejected the Obama administration's offer to make the announcement and therefore give Trump and Flynn a clean start with the Turkish government. He said, no, we might reexamine this decision, but at the time he was a paid agent of the Turkish government. So it's an extremely troubling conflict of interest that really deserves more scrutiny.
Well, you have to take it a little further, don't you, Max Hoffman? I mean, the FBI apparently have hanging over Flynn, who's trying to make a deal and says he's got a story to tell, or at least his lawyer says that. Flynn apparently met with representatives from Erdogan and promised that somehow he could kidnap Gulen and have him rendered, or renditioned, I guess is the word, to Turkey. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I mean, and the source on that, of course, is the former head of the CIA, Jim Woolsey. You said he came in the meeting later, but that's what the meeting was about. That's pretty explosive, isn't it?
It is. I mean, one can only hope that these were, sort of crazy ideas being thrown around and not seriously, right. Because the very idea is just shocking. The overall context here, it's being overshadowed because this administration is struggling to extract itself from these various conflicts, which everyone, had been warning about for months and months and months, even before the election. But the more important, or the equally important issue here is the relationship with this key NATO ally in Turkey and what's happened domestically in Turkey. This is, the Obama administration tried to balance. We have very important, the U.S. has very important strategic interests in Turkey and with Turkey in the region. The Obama administration tried to balance some of those military security concerns with at least voicing criticism or warnings to Turkey about their domestic crackdown and this authoritarian drift under Erdogan. They didn't always say enough in the eyes of their critics about democracy in Turkey or human rights, but they at least balanced it a little bit. This new administration, the Trump administration, though, has really jettisoned any concern for human rights or democracy. The problem there is that Turkey can't be a reliable long-term ally of the United States and a reliable NATO ally if it continues this, highly nationalistic and anti-democratic drift. So, I think we should all hope that the set of issues expands moving forward, or we could be in for a bumpy road.
But just to focus on the personality, since this man has such an unbridled ego and he built this massive palace for himself in Ankara, there are certain analogies with Vladimir Putin, who when he first came into power, you recall George W. Bush looked into his eyes and saw his soul. There was a period when he seemed to be at least going along with the vestiges of democracy in Russia and then quickly turned to kleptocracy and autocracy, which is what Erdogan's doing. I mean, he started out with zero problems with neighbors. Well, you know, he did very well for a while. The AKP became very popular, and there were real reforms and real economic progress. And then he sort of turned into an autocrat and a kleptocrat. So do you detect a kind of comparison there?
There are echoes of the story in Russia. I don't think Turkey's there yet, and I think that the Turkish society is extremely diverse. They have a very vibrant middle class. Its ties to Europe are deep, particularly the economic ties, which the Turkish economy relies on. And Turkish civil society and the opposition are still there. I mean, as you mentioned, he barely won this recent referendum, but essentially 50% of the country, including the three largest cities, voted against the proposed constitutional changes to hand Erdogan more power. He still got it, and the provisions will allow him to expand near absolute control, I would say, over the judiciary, which is extremely troubling. He'll be able to name the whole cabinet and pass budgets without parliament. He could dissolve parliament, although that will also send the presidency to an election, so there's a disincentive there. I mean, he has tremendous power. He's by far the dominant force in Turkish politics. But I think long-term, Turkey has perhaps a little bit more resiliency. It's not a resource-based extraction economy the way Russia is with energy. And Turkish democracy, despite its many shortcomings and challenges, has deeper roots. And so I think that combined with its ties to Europe, its reliance on European investment, and the way it's rooted in the Western security architecture through NATO, hopefully will avoid the absolute worst outcome. But it's an extremely concerning situation, and Turkish democracy is certainly on life support, and it needs all the help it can get from the U.S. and Europe. And unfortunately, we're everybody is fairly distracted these days with internal problems. So it's a worrying situation.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you very much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish region's U.S. defense budgeting and policy and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He's organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing a comparison that the United States ambassador to the UN has made between the Assad regime and the Nazis. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
A pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And unfortunately, Josh, every time we talk, it's usually about something pretty grim, because you're an expert
true.
On Syria, a country that's been destroyed. I think half of its population is displaced, at least 500,000 people being killed. And now we learn that there are analogies being suggested by the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, accusing President Bashar al-Assad of Syria an attempt to cover up mass murder in the Assad crematoriums in their prisons is reminiscent of the 20th century's worst offences against humanity. Clearly a parallel with Nazi Germany. What do you make of this latest revelation that their crematorium was set up in the Sydney prison complex to dispose of the thousands of people that the Assad regime had been murdering in prisons?
Well, we know that Sydney prison, which is about 30 kilometers from Damascus, has been a place where political prisoners have been held for a long time. In 2008, it became a prominent it came to the news because there was a prison revolt by Islamist prisoners, and about 28 of them were shot by guards who put down very brutally this prison insurrection. That got a lot of play, a focus on Sydney as a center of this holding Islamic prisoners. Then, at the beginning of the Syrian uprising, 2011, pressure was put on Assad to release political prisoners, and he did so. Many of those political prisoners were Islamists. Now, of course, the regime holds mostly Islamists because that's much of the opposition to the regime has come from Muslim Brothers, other Islamic groups that have organized in Syria. And the release was, of course, very controversial because many of those people released went on to become leaders or influential in the uprising that became increasingly Islamist. Many people said that Assad had expressly released these Islamist people in order to ruin the uprising and turn it from a fairly non-religious to becoming a very religious uprising. At any rate, the accusations of abuse in Syria's prisons have come fast and furious since then. We know that the regime has tortured people in big numbers, that there have been lots of deaths in the prison. In 2014, a slew of photos were released by the Qatari government and an international law firm that had worked with a defector, a photographer from Syria's prisons that had worked for the regime photographing the dead. And in this big report about the accusation was that about 6,700 prisoners were documented in these photographs, more than 50,000 photographs. Many of them showed signs of torture, abuse, starvation, and disease. So the conditions in those prisons are horrifying. Torture is a regular part of prison life in Syria. Now, in 2016, Amnesty International said that about 10,000 people were, 10 people were being executed a day. And now we get this report saying 50 are killed or die in Syrian prisons in Sydney every day. So that is a, catalog of terrible abuse. Now, of course, to put this in some context, none of the various militias in Syria have been taking prisoners. This is the, horrible reality of Syrian fighting. We've seen ISIS march out hundreds of prisoners into the desert in underwear, making them bleat like sheep, and then put bullets in the back of their head, dig their own graves, that kind of thing. Many of the other opposition groups summarily execute regime prisoners and the prisoners of their enemy rebel groups. So this is a killing field. We saw this in Iraq, similar fighting between Shiite and Sunni groups, mass executions. And unfortunately, it's descended into this, what is sort of like World War II, where prisoners were shot summarily, Jews were executed and burnt in crematoriums.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Of course, Nazis tattooed the Jewish prisoners, which is an anathema to Orthodox Jews. And in this case, burning bodies, cremating bodies, is also an anathema to devout Muslims, is it not?
I believe so. And the normal way to bury a Muslim, of course, is to wrap them in a sheet and to bury them within a day of death.
So What do you make then of the release of this information by the State Department, as understaffed as it is, and then having Nikki Haley at the UN, as I mentioned, make these analogies with the Assad regime in Nazi Germany, and then go on to say, quote, the rest of the world recognizes the horrors of the Syrian regime. It is time for Russia to join us. I noticed that the Russians helped broker the evacuation of rebel fighters from suburbs of Damascus that had been pounded into obliteration. They and their families were allowed on these buses to get out, and that was done under the protection of the Russians. So what's going on here in terms of the bigger political maneuverings between the U.S., the Trump regime, and Putin's Russia?
Well, of course, this does have political significance. The State Department has issued this report the day before Geneva peace talks were to take place, which have unfolded today. And we've seen in the past a 2014 report on this, the Caesar report, the code name for this prison photographer, was issued right before Geneva talks, previous Geneva talks were supposed. So we've seen a regular, in a sense, drumbeat of these reports being issued the day before the two sides were supposed to sit down in Geneva. That is clearly designed in order to create a media environment in which the reporters ask about these horrible atrocities to the regime figures when they're going to be a lot of news around those events. And this of course helps the American side, the rebel side, because the regime is exposed as a killer, and the focus goes off of their demerits and their shortcomings, and focuses then on the shortcomings of the regime. So this is to help America try to put pressure on Russia to get it to make concessions and to put pressure on the Assad regime to stop being a human rights violator.
So, since you know the country well, Joshua Landis, you're married to a Syrian and spent a lot of time in the country, I know it's not unique, countries turning against their own citizens, and even ones that were nominally civilized, to the want of a better description. Like, for example, in Argentina, the dirty war, the military did the most horrendous.
Or even the United States, where in our civil war,
right,
where 700,000 Americans were killed in that civil war, which is, in a country that was 30 million at the time of the civil war, a little bit larger than Syria's population, but the killing was on the same scale.
Right.
And the U.S. took, I believe, over 400,000 prisoners on both sides, and 50,000 of those prisoners died in captivity during the civil war. So this is not an unusual thing for prisoners during civil wars to be starved, not given medical attention, and in some cases executed like this. And so this is a terrible one of the terrible aspects of civil war.
But in this case, the starvation of civilians, the murder of civilians, has been a part of a military strategy on the part of the Assad regime, just pure terror, dropping barrel bombs, using chemical weapons, etc. So the civil war, I mean, we know they all lined up against each other and shot each other in that insane way. But it wasn't. This one seems to be a little bit more heinous.
More brutal.
This,
it would seem to be.
Yeah.
It would seem to be more brutal indeed, and there are more, I guess, refined techniques of killing people today. Mm. Than there were in the 1860s.
Sure. But it leads to the question, though, about the mentality of Assad. I mean, he clearly does not see the people, his own fellow citizens that he's murdering, as humans. I mean, it's pretty hard not to, you know, they're all the same people. They all have the same DNA. They speak the same language. They live in the same country. They live next door to each other. And yet he treats them like cockroaches to be exterminated.
That's true, and that kind of language is used, and of rats and so forth, because he terms these people as terrorists, and of course, in Syrian law, you can execute capital punishment for terrorists is the law, and these summary courts pass down their judgment without proper jury or anything else. And these prisoners who are captured and accused of terrorism are then executed. And they're seen as agents of foreign powers, of the United States and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, that are enemy powers, and they're seen as really, they're cast as non-Syrians, as an other. Much, you know, that is what is going on, no doubt about it.
So is this just going to end through sheer exhaustion? And I mean, I can't see the rebels ever surrendering. They occupy a lot of territory, but it's not the urban, it's not the important, it's not the coastal regions. I know Assad is determined to win back every inch of territory, and you've already got the Kurds working with the Americans, so they're not going to get all their territory, and that's obviously a bone of contention in today's White House meetings between Erdogan and Trump. But at the end of the day, what do you see as a post-Civil War Syria?
Boy, a very fragmented Syria. As you say, the Kurds have been very fortunate because they have won U.S. backing. The U.S. is supplying them now with some heavy weaponry and much more advanced weaponry, night vision goggles, good sniper rifles, all kinds of heavy-duty firepower. Not tanks, but a lot of things short of tanks, artillery and so forth. This is going to help in the war against ISIS, but the Kurds are going to be able to use this, not only the diplomatic support, but the military support, in order to carve out a largely autonomous region in the north of Syria. They're not asking for complete independence, but they do want a large degree of autonomy. How they will square that with the Assad regime remains to be seen, whether they'll be fighting between the two or they come to the table and work out some kind of an agreement in which Syrian government would nominally be in charge of this region, but it would be Kurds ruling the situation on the ground, something similar to what we have in Iraq, where the U.S. helped the Kurds emerge as a quasi-independent state in the north of Iraq. Now, what's going to happen to the rebel groups in this large rebel region around Idlib remains to be seen. The United States has actually been bombing parts of those rebel groups, the ones where al-Qaeda is the strongest, executing their leadership when they can spot them. Otherwise, it's been Assad who's been pounding them with every kind of artillery and bombs. We saw Assad use chemical weapons tentatively in March, and the United States put its foot down, bombed the airport where those chemical weapons were launched from, and Assad hasn't used them since. So, but it is very difficult to see how the rebels, in the long run, can hold out. Increasingly, Turkey, their main backer, is moving towards Russia. Saudi Arabia is sucked into the war in Yemen, which is exhausting it and causing it to run way over budget. How long Saudi Arabia can bankroll Syria's rebels remains to be seen. But without these major backers, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the United States, European powers, the rebels in the Idlib province in western Syria would seem, it seems to be only a matter of time before the regime, which is backed, as we know, by Iran, Russia, Iraq, Hezbollah, and Lebanon, reconquers that territory.
Well, Joshua Landis, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure. I wish it weren't such a grim picture.
I know. Well, again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes the Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.